All right. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank everybody for coming out to the shiur by Rabbi Arya Leibowitz this morning. I'd like to thank this morning's sponsors, Dina and Saul Kasevitz, in commemoration of the yard site of Saul's mother, Sarah Leah Bas Harav Shaul, and Vivian Kasevitz, Tehinish Masa Tzur B'Tzur Achayim. It's always a pleasure, I don't know if it's a chazaka or more at this point, to have the zechus to hear words of Torah from Rabbi Leibowitz on Thanksgiving morning. It's probably his third shiur of the day, so we thank him for coming out and gracing us with his words of Torah. I'm scared if I say the words, which should be said, needs no introduction, he'll actually walk up and cut me off in the middle of my introduction, so I'm being careful with my Lashonos right here. But as they used to say back in the day, before I was around, that in order to have smicha, you needed to know Hilchos Shabbos and have Rav Moshe's cell phone number. All right, this is before cell phones. Home phone number. This way, you know, you can always call Rav Moshe if you have a shaila. And on Shabbos, you know, you're on your own, left to your own devices. So maybe an offshoot of that nowadays could be you need to know Hilchos Shabbos and have at least 10 minutes to answer the questions. You could quickly upload Y'e Torah, find the 10-minute or 5 minutes, you can sit on a double speed in order to access some of Rabbi Leibowitz's unbelievably clear and concise Divrei Torah to help everybody, not just the Rabbanim, but Balabatim, the like. You know, my own family, my parents, my brother, my sister-in-law, my nephew, all avid listeners. Rabbi Leibowitz's Daf Yomi, the spectrum, the scope in which the audience in which Rabbi Leibowitz hits is truly incredible. It's actually always exciting for me to hear him in person. I have my ADD, like many of us, we listen on 1.5 or 2 speeds. So it's nice to hear his voice as a normal human. But it's really, I don't want to take any more Rabbi Leibowitz's time. Yeah. And to cover God, for us to hear some words of Torah from Rabbi Leibowitz.
Thank you, Rabbi Wormger. Just a pro tip. If you skip to the last 2 minutes, I normally just tell you what the halacha is at the end. Thank you all for joining this morning, for coming to learn together. I feel so at home over here in Bnei Yeshur and in Tinek in general. It's so wonderful to see so many friends and Talmidim to all come to learn together on the day that you have off from work. And it's really always inspiring to see how we use our free time to be able to learn some Torah, hopefully gain some knowledge and some inspiration as well. You know, one of the important things, one of the important things to look for in learning, I was makabel from my rebbeim, is you always look for yesodos. You look for foundations. You look for ideas that can be applied universally or that can be applied in many different places. My rebbeim always taught us that when it comes to certain details in the sugya, you can learn through them fairly quickly. And when it comes to certain foundational ideas, that's where you really need to put your focus. Because when it comes to foundational ideas, no matter what masechta you're learning, no matter what area of limud that you're engaged in, you'll be able to find some sort of application. You'll be able to have a deeper understanding of whatever it is that you're learning. And if that's true in lamdus, it's even more true when a lamdusha idea also turns out to be a yesod in life, also turns out to be a foundational idea that can help us in just our general hashkafas hachayim, and our general attitude toward life. So I'd like to share with you this morning an idea that I heard from one of my newer rabbeim, I would say, Rabbi Yisrael Reisman Shlita, on that's a yesod in learning, and I think is a yesod in life, and maybe we'll expand. Most of it is from him, but maybe we'll expand on the idea in a number of ways as well. Let's start with the parsha. Probably the most obvious question on the entire story of Sefer Bereishis is, how could Yitzchak have so badly missed the boat on Esav? I mean, it's mind-boggling. I understand he was blind, but he was a remarkably intelligent person. He was an extremely capable person. So despite his disability, despite his blindness, he should have been able to understand who Esav was. He should have been able to understand who Yaakov was and the potential that Yaakov had. Is it possible that he thought that Esav was greater than Yaakov, despite all of the evidence to the contrary? Very hard to imagine. Didn't he communicate at all with Rivka? You know, when we teach chassadim in kallahs, I remember when my wife started teaching kallahs, she said, I find myself just using the word communicate like 1,000 times. So yeah, I think you're doing it right then, right? And that's like the most important thing, to know how to communicate, not just that you communicate, but how you communicate, to communicate effectively and properly and with the proper amount of love and respect and all of those things. So where was the communication in this marriage? How is it that Yitzchak and Rivka were on such different pages about the most important element of their marriage, which is to raise children, to be able to raise children for the next generation, especially at this formational stage in Klal Yisrael's history? You know, in Shas, we have a principle that when there's an argument, we assume that the two sides are not diametrically opposed. We assume that they agree on 99% of the points, and then there's like this one point of disagreement. And part of learning is to figure out what that one point of it, we even use the term nekuda samachlokas. A nekuda, it's a nekuda, it's a point of machlokas. Everything else they agree on, but there's one point where there's machlokas, there's some specific detail. We shown them, achronim work so hard to show that the shitos are almost perfectly in sync with each other, but they disagree on a particular detail, rather than to say that they just viewed the world in entirely different ways. So Yitzchak and Rivka, we're going to say they just, you know, menakotze elakotze, that they viewed the world in entirely different ways, that they viewed their own children in entirely different ways. How do we come to grips with that? How do we understand how Yitzchak and Rivka would be so divergent in their views of their own children? And the second question, Rav Nissen Alpert points out in his Sefer Limudei Nisan, I was just listening yesterday in the car, Mechavusa Rabbi Rosner, in the first vart on this week's Parsha Shir, raised this Rav Nissen Alpert. He pointed out that the very first time in the Torah that somebody is described as being tired, as being a yef, is Esav. Now, I met Avram lived a busy life, right? You read the Rambam in Hilchos Avot Chavim about what Avram Avinu's life was like. He would schlep around from town to town and get on his soapbox and he'd start telling people all about this idea of monotheism, and he'd start pitching it. And then he had tens of thousands of followers eventually that he had to deal with. You know, he was running like this mega shul of tens of thousands of followers. And he had a busy life. He was like the most important political figure of his time. It never describes Avram Avinu as tired. Never described. You know, you ask most people, anybody, like, how you doing today? Like one of the first things that people generally use to describe themselves is tired, tired. Esav is the first person that's described as tired. And why? It's an introduction to why Esav sells the Bechorah. He sells the Bechorah because apparently he's tired. Now, is that really the right introduction? I would have said he sold the Bechorah. What would you have said? What did he sell it for? A bowl of soup, beans, whatever. I don't remember. But how would you describe him? He was hungry. He was hungry. And wasn't that being tired? Okay, tired people tend to be hungry. If you're tired from exhaustion, you get hungry. Okay, but it doesn't say that he was hungry. It says that he was tired. Why is it the fact that he's tired relevant to the story? Not only relevant, it's the point the Torah decides to make right before it describes the Mechiras HaBechorah. Vayavo Esav min Asadav hu ayeh. And he was tired. I would think it would be more relevant to say that he was hungry. Then finally, a third question. We find that Moshe Rabbeinu took care of the Atzmos Yosef after Yosef dies, well after Yosef dies. And he schleps them all the way from Mitzrayim, and his job is to bring them to Eretz Yisrael, to Kvura in Eretz Yisrael. Of course, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't ultimately rebury the Atmos Yosef, because he himself didn't make it all the way into Eretz Yisrael. So it's so strange that Moshe Rabbeinu risked and spent so much time and energy working on making sure that he had the Atmos Yosef with him wherever he went, and then he doesn't get to see it through. He dies in the Midbar. Aaron dies in the Midbar, and they just leave them there, and they say, oh, I'll take the Atzmos Yosef from you, and they just carry on with the Atzmos Yosef. Meaning, obviously, Moshe Rabbeinu thought that this was an important thing, to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Obviously, he thought that this was worth spending 40 years schlepping around a box of bones in order to get them buried in Eretz Yisrael. And yet somehow Moshe and Aaron don't get kvura in Eretz Yisrael. They're at the doorstep of Eretz Yisrael. They're right there. It wouldn't have taken 40 years. And nobody thought to take their remains for kvura in Eretz Yisrael, even as they picked up Yosef's remains and carried them the rest of the way. Why would people prioritize Yosef's remains over Moshe and Aaron's remains? I realize that's not this week's parsha, but just another question to think about. So again, three questions. Number one, how could it be that Yitzhak and Rivka were so divergent in their views of their own children, of such an important issue of their own children? Second of all, why is it that Esav is described as tired? And third, why is it that Yosef's remains make it all the way to Eretz Yisrael? Moshe and Aaron don't. Moshe and Aaron are at the doorstep of Eretz Yisrael, but they don't get quite to make it to Eretz Yisrael. So I heard the following idea from Rabbi Reisman Shlita. He said that his Rebbe, Rav Pam, used to have an expression, and he used to quote it in the name of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish had an expression. I don't speak Yiddish, and when I try, I sometimes fail. So if you do speak Yiddish, just either correct me on my pronunciation or live with it. That the Rav Pam used to say in the name of the Chazon Ish, "Mirais nish mezuzas." We don't tear mezuzas down. No. Okay, shkoyach, I don't tear mezuzahs down. I don't drop tefillin on the floor. There are a lot of things I don't do that are, inappropriate. What does it mean, mereis nish mezuzahs? We don't tear mezuzahs down. It means that if a person has a mezuzah that's already on the doorpost, and that mezuzah is 100% kosher, and then you're presented with an opportunity to buy a mezuzah that is super mahuta, that is magnificent in its beauty, that's done by the greatest sofer in the world, that went to the mitzvah before writing every letter, I don't know, whatever the hidurim are that you're looking for. You should not upgrade the mezuzah. Miraislish mezuzahs. You don't tear down a mezuzah. You have a kosher mezuzah on your door, you leave it on your door. Now, obviously, when you're shopping for a mezuzah, you should shop for the best mezuzah. You should look for the most muhudar. You should look for the most beautiful. I always tell Talmidim when they first get married, they're looking for, how do I get a mezuzah? And, they don't have that much money when you first get married. But, these mezuzahs are going to be with you likely for the rest of your life. And it's a one-time purchase. How much are you going to spend on an esrog, which will be with you for a week? A mezuzah you can have every day, every moment of every day, probably for decades. And, especially if you live in an apartment where they're going to paint in between, you're actually allowed to take the mezuzahs with you in those cases. So it's worth the investment. And how do most people buy mezuzahs? They go into a store and they say, what you got? They say, well, we got $60, $80, and $100. Okay, I'm an average Jew. I'll take the $80. They don't know if it's a Sephardic mezuzah, an Ashkenazi. They have no idea what they're even looking. That's terrible, right? We should make sure that we buy the most mehudar and the most beautiful and the nicest mezuzahs we can. But once you've already purchased a mezuzah and you started to use it, you cannot abandon it. If there's some sort of suffix in the kashrus, of course, you find a better one. But just to upgrade the hidur, when you already have a perfectly kosher mezuzah, mirais nish mezuzahs. And this is a yesod, if you pay attention in halacha, comes up time and time again. In fact, I would challenge you to try to, as you learn through, as you learn through halacha, and you hear about all sorts of different shiurim, and you do all your own learning. Try to think where else this comes up. I'm going to give you four examples. Rabbi Reisman gave three. I'm going to give a fourth as well. There's an idea in Igros Moshe, or Chaim Chelek Beis Siman Lamed Zayin, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe writes, Uma shehevi achacham tzvi misefer chazidim, de biyuriya ksuva besefer Torah b'ksiva she'ina yafa. The Chacham Tzvi quotes from a Sefer Chassidim. If you have a Sefer Torah, and there's one section of the Sefer Torah that's not so nice, where the writing is not as beautiful, Umatza achar kach sofer uman, and then you find an expert scribe, Shemitzava lahachlifa yiriya binna'a heimena, who says, I can upgrade that for you. The whole rest of it, a lot of times this happens with Megillahs, because when people first learn to write Safos, usually the first thing they learn to write is a Megillah. And usually, it's a trick that they have, is they start writing at the end, because they're not so good yet. So, and they know when people go by a Megillah, they'll open up at the beginning. So by then, they have a lot of practice by the time they get to the beginning. So that's, if you ever buy a Megillah, just another pro tip, look at the end of the Megillah. Because if it's the guy's first Megillah, he's very likely much better at writing by the time he gets to the, you're allowed to write a Megillah out of order. So that's what they do. They tafka write it out of order and they get to, sometimes you may have a Megillah, let's say, that the first three quarters, you know, there are four sections. The first three quarters of it are magnificent, are really nice. And the fourth one, you know, he was just learning. He was just trying to figure it out. And yeah, it's kosher, but not so nice. So says Rav Moshe, that the Sofer saw, and he said, you know, I'll upgrade your Sefer Torah. We'll take out that Uriah, the one section that's not as nice. Says Rav Moshe, l'chora tamua. What a strange thing to do. So arada mikadusha kishnotu mi Sefer Torah k'shera shizot var iser. You can't pull out a perfectly kosher Uriah from his Sefer Torah. What do you mean I can't? I'm upgrading. I'm doing a better Hidur. I'm making a better mitzvah. You can't pull out a perfectly, can't remove a full Uriah from a Sefer Torah. Yeah, you have the opportunity to upgrade to a nicer one. We don't just abandon a kosher section of a Sefer Torah unless there's a question of psul. A second riot. Hilchos Chanukah, it's Rosh Chodesh Kislev. Hilchos Chanukah. Shmos Yaakov and the Chacham Tzvi discuss a case where someone sets up a menorah with wax candles. Now, what's the most mahuder way to fulfill the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah? Shemen Zayis, right? You want to have oil. What a person set up with wax candles. Rav Shechter told us, Rav Soloveitchik, when he would travel, he would always come from Boston to YU to say Shir. And he said, Kisei there every year, he forgot his menorah at home. Like that was, he was just absent-minded sometimes. He forgot his menorah at home every year. Rav Shechter loves to tell the story, actually, how Rav Soloveitchik used to, he would daven Marv early. He would daven Marv right after Shkia because he'd get busy later at night. He'd be nervous that he wouldn't be able to find a minyan. So every once in a while, if he didn't daven Marv early, and at the end of the night, he came back to yeshiva, and it was 12:30 at night, and he hadn't daven Marv yet, he would ask Bachram, who were still up in the dorms, to help make a minyan. And he would say, what's tzaddikim that they come make a minyan at 12:30 at night? Rav Shechter said he didn't realize they hadn't davened yet, and it was 12:30 at night. If not for that, they weren't going to daven at all. But he used to try to daven like right after Shkia, because he knew that he would get busy later. So one time he was getting ready, he was trying to gather together a minion to daven, and one of the young men, I guess, didn't know who he was, if that was possible in the day. And the person said, the young boy said to him, you're not allowed to daven yet. It's only right after Shkia. He said, no, I'm going to be busy later. I said, but Kriya Shema's d'oraisa. You can't be yosek Kriya Shema yet. He said, I'll say Kriya Shema. The guy said, promise me you're going to say Kriya Shema later. So I promise. So they daven Marv, and Rav Soloveitchik used to light Ner Chanukah like 10 minutes after Shkia, like right after Marv, 15 minutes after Shkia, 10, 15 minutes after Shkia. That was his minute. That's what he held was the ideal time to light. So he didn't have his menorah because he never had his menorah. So he took a piece of foil and he took wax candles and he melted the bottom and just like, you know, stuck them onto the foil. And that's how he lit. And the same boy who told him, made him promise that he was going to, said, Rav Shechter Paskins, you need a kli. Because Rav Shechter likes to quote an Avnei Nezer, I think it is, that holds that you're not allowed to do that, that you need a kli to hold the actual oil. So Soloveitchik said, tell Shechter that Soloveitchik said that he's crazy. So Rav Shechter said, the boy did a shlichus. He came to me and he told me. So if you look in Nefesh HaRav, when Rav Shechter talks about Ner Chanukah, he says, you know, Ayin Avnei Nezer, that you're supposed to have a kli. And Rav Soloveitchik, I forgot the exact lesson, but something like, and Rav Soloveitchik, hikbit bazeh ma'od, you know, he was very unhappy with that. You know, that was the lesson that Rav Shechter used, but that was the backstory. But anyway, there is a machlokas between the Shus Yaakov and the Chacham Tzvi. You already set up your wax candles because you didn't have any oil. So you set up wax candles. And then someone brings oil for you. Do you upgrade to oil? So Shvos Yaakov says, if you set up your candles, you do not remove perfectly kosher candles and abandon a perfectly kosher item in order to accomplish a hidur of using oil. And even the Chacham Tzvi, who argues, only does so because the case is that you hadn't begun to light the menorah yet. But once you start actually lighting the menorah, even the Chacham Tzvi agrees that you cannot abandon mid-mitzvah a mitzvah that's perfectly kosher in order to upgrade to a hidur. A third example. There's a halacha that when a king dies and he has multiple sons, even if the younger one, the younger son is the most qualified, as long as the older son is not unqualified, the older son takes over the malchus. Doesn't always work that way in Hasidic dynasties. Ramesh Stav pointed out in Karen Biava once that Hasidic dynasty work more like potatoes. When you put one in the ground, four pop out. But the ideally, right, the halacha is if there's going to be only one successor, that the successor should be the oldest son, even if he's not the most talented. So perhaps the idea is that if something is kosher, you don't overlook it in search of something better. And then a fourth example. There's a din in Hilchos Tzitzis. Shulchan Aruch and Siman Yud Beis Paskins that if one of the strings of your tzitzis snaps at the knot, the tzitzis are still kosher l'chaladeus. So instead of 32 strings, on your four corners, you end up with 31. Because one snapped. Kosher l'chaladeus. No machlokes. However, having exactly 32 strings is not only a hidur in the halacha, Kabbalistically, it's considered to be something very important. The Svarim HaKadoshim say that it protects, I'm not sure which Svarim, but the Svarim HaKadoshim say that it protects a person from promiscuity and from other things. It's considered something very chash to have 32 strings. So it would seem clear that if one string snaps, you should replace the strings in order to have the most muhudar and Kabbalistically ideal tzitzis that you could possibly have. I had this happen last summer in Camp Gailey. One of my strings snapped on my tzitzis. My tchelis. So the question is, but the tchelis is intact. One of the loving strings snapped. So what do I do? So should I take apart the tzitzis and buy new tzitzis and tie new strings onto the tzitzis and get rid of the old tzitzis? Shulchan HaTovar, Siman Tezvav Sif Aleph writes that if you plan on being machmir to retie the tzitzis, you should retie the same strings, just position them differently so that the string will be long enough. Don't replace the strings. Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Mora Katsiyah Simit Hezvav, you can only take the strings off if you'll actually place them in another beged. In the Sefer Keser Rosh, they quote that Rav Chaim Volozhiner was makbid not to untie the tzitzis that had a din of gardumin that were still kosher. Because Mirais Nish Mezuzis. You have a kosher talis, it's a kosher talis. You don't abandon a mitzvah that you've already committed to, that you already have. A yisod in halacha, it seems. Now, the Yeshal Avram Yibachach, or Avram David Yibachach, says that he heard from Rav Menachem Mendel Mirimanov that it is important to replace the torn string, but he says that's only if it's entirely torn. But if there's a Kedei Aniva left, even though it's not beautiful, it's not great, gotta leave it. You're not allowed to take it apart. Right? So I have a question for you. We can now agree, it seems like he is so, right? Four rayas can't be a coincidence, right? So it seems like he is so. You know, sometimes if you had one, you would say it's a kasha. I don't understand. Why don't I get new strings? Rav Yonason Sachs likes to say that when a person has four kashas on a sugya, he doesn't have four kashas. He has four rayas that he doesn't yet understand the sugya. And then once you find that you sow, you'll appreciate that every kasha is really a raya. And so we could have asked this as four kashas. But it's not four kashas, it's a yisod, meraisnish mezuzos, and here are four yisod, four rayas that yisod is true. But why? Isn't hidur something, you know, we're about to celebrate Hanukkah in a few weeks. Isn't the whole thing about finding that Shemen Zayizach, about finding that the seal of the Kohen Gadol, and Tumah Hutra B'tzibur, and right, that we've heard this kasha before, right? And we're looking for the best, the nicest. Isn't that the attitude? Isn't that what we're always supposed to do? And the answer seems to be, of course, initially, that's what we're supposed to do. But once you have the mitzvah, you don't abandon the mitzvah. Perhaps it relates to bizui mitzvah, that you don't want to be mevazel like Rav Moshe understood in that tshuva. Perhaps bizui mitzvah, but maybe there's something deeper. Maybe it's teaching us just not to have a disposable attitude toward mitzvos, but to learn to stick with things. And maybe it's even more than that. Not just that when you have something of value that you stick with it and you don't just discard it, but maybe there's a certain connection and a certain maila to that which you've already been able to fulfill a mitzvah through. And maybe that's even a greater hidur than all of the other hidurim. Rabbi Shai Shechter told me that he was once giving a shiur about Esrog Hakushi, the Gemara talks about an esrog that is an Ethiopian esrog. So an alter yid came over to him, a Holocaust survivor came over to him after the shir, and he said to him, "You've probably never seen an esrog hakushi, but when I was growing up in Hungary," I think he said Hungary, we didn't have any esrog in our community, and in all the neighboring towns there was one esrog. So what they did is they hired a guy to take the esrog by wagon from one town to the next town, so that everyone can have a chance with the esrog to do the mitzvah of esrog. He said, "I was the youngest kid in the last town to get the esrog. By the time I had the esrog in my hand, it was an esrog hakushi. It was a blackened esrog. It had been handled so much." And he said, "Let me tell you, it was the most beautiful esrog I've ever seen." Rabbi Shai Shechter was so moved by that. He told his father, and his father said, "That's not what esrog hakushi means. It means an Ethiopian esrog." Okay, but still, go with the story. Right, that there's hidur in that. That there's beauty in the fact that I've already used this for the mitzvah, and I'm not going to discard it as soon as something nicer comes along. So Verizman suggested Moshe and Aaron were buried in Eivar Yarden, while the bones of Yosef were carried all the way into Eretz Yisrael. They didn't bring Moshe and Aaron into Eretz Yisrael proper, because the place that they died actually is Eretz Yisrael. It's just not Spitz Eretz Yisrael, meaning it's what we call today Eretz Yisrael. Where Moshe Rabbeinu was, when you go to Israel, right, you will be where Moshe Rabbeinu was. It's just not as high a level as the mainland. Yosef died in Mitzrayim, so they carried him all the way to Eretz Yisrael, so to have Kvuras Eretz Yisrael. But Moshe and Aaron were already in Eretz Yisrael. You don't abandon Kvura in Eretz Yisrael for better Kvura Be'eretz Yisrael. When Esav is described as a Yev, maybe it doesn't simply mean that he was tired, but that he would easily tire of things. And that maybe is the best introduction to what he was about to do. That here he was about to sell the Bechorah, something that was extremely valuable, but it didn't really serve a purpose right now. And if right now it didn't seem so great, he would cast it aside. Maybe that's the midah of Esav, that if there was something of value that didn't seem to work for him in the moment, it was disposable. It was something that he was willing to cast aside. In fact, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses Avram Avinu, the Torah tells us why Avram was chosen. And it wasn't because he was the greatest tzaddik, and it wasn't because of any of the particular nisyonos that he had done, the Torah says. Ki yedativ l'ma'an asher yitzaveh as banav ve'as beisal achrav. Because I know he's all in. He's fully committed. He's not a fair weather friend. He's going to be here tomorrow. He's going to be here in the next generation and the generation that follows. And that midah of sticking to it was what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was looking for. And it could be, says Rabbi Reisman, that Yitzchak Avinu was perfectly aware that Yaakov was much greater than Esav. His mistake was only in thinking that Esav was adequate. And if Esav was adequate, Mereis Nish Mezuzis. That's where the machlokas was. Yitzchak and Rivka both knew that Yaakov was superior. He was the younger Hasidish Rebbe's son who was spectacular. But if the older son was adequate, then you don't bypass the older son. Is Esav a puzzle mezuzah or just one that's not Wahudar? Maybe that was the machlokas. So more broadly speaking, we live in a generation that tears down lots of mezuzahs. We live in a generation, again, this is not a schmooze about gashmius. Look for the most beautiful things in ruchnius and gashmius. When you want to buy something, yeah, buy something great, buy something beautiful. But just the nature of our generation, you know, it used to be you'd buy a car, right? And then you'd try to buy the nicest car you could afford. And you would drive it until like hundreds of thousands of miles and things were falling off. And you had to know which way to angle the key. And you had to like shake four things in it to get the thing to start. And, you know, I remember when I started driving, my father had a car, like there was like an instruction manual, like he left on the visor. It was like a whole list of things that you had to do in order to get the car to start. Nowadays, we lease cars. So you get a new car, you run into the ground for 2 years, and then you get a new one. Everything is always, if you have an iPhone, you're gonna use an iPhone 12, like some sort of animal or something. iPhone 14, I mean, right? 14 is that we're up to? We're just always trading things out. It's just the nature of our society. It's the way we live. And unfortunately, this sometimes has an impact on our relationships as well. According to the American Psychological Association, close to 50% of first marriages end in divorce. We have a Torah that has a parsha of Gittin and a Shas that has an entire Masechta in Gittin, but the possibility of divorce is viewed as something that's worthy of the Mizbeach being Morid Demos. And we know the tremendously positive impact that a healthy marriage has on a person's mental and physical well-being, and how good it is for children growing up in a happy home, and how it serves to protect them from mental and physical, educational, social problems. But we live in a society where it's just very easy to abandon things. Where does that stunning and self-defeating divorce rate come from? Why would people punish themselves like this? Why would they do it to themselves? I mean, you look at the studies about the amount of depression and loneliness and isolation and self-esteem difficulties and all of that. It's a challenge. It's a huge challenge. You look at the storylines of contemporary television and movies, which you shouldn't. And you notice that there's like a very common storyline. Somebody's in a marriage that's no longer exciting. And then they meet somebody new. A person who seems to be so much better, has so much more charm, is more doting on them, and just like seems like a newer and shinier version of their spouse who they have fallen out of love with. An emotionally healthy person writing that story would have the hero reject such a relationship and instead work on their marriage to give it the best chance of success. After all, there's no greater predictor of overall happiness in life and emotional stability of your children than a long and stable marriage. But that's not the storyline. The hero of the story follows their heart. The movie ends with them going off into the sunset together. And if they made a sequel, it would end with that marriage ending in divorce and following the next shiny thing. But if Daniel Kalish recently coined the phrase, at least I recently heard it from him, that in the secular world, they describe love. In our world, we produce love. When love is a description of how a person feels at a given moment, then the instant that that feeling goes away, there's no need to stick around. We view love as something that we view love as something that could be built, something that could be nurtured. When a man says to a woman, "Hare at mekudesh li b'tavah zo k'das Moshe b'Yisrael," and she accepts that ring, they're committing to be there for each other at times when they make each other feel good and at times when they don't. Ezer Kenegdor, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein once described, the Chazal tells us, Zacha Ezer, lo Zacha Kenegdor. He says, you know what that means? Zacha means when you're right, she'll be an Ezer. And when you're lo Zacha, when you're wrong, she'll be Kenegdor. She'll tell you that you're wrong. And that's part of marriage also. That's the Lashon of Ahava V'Achva. Once you have love, you would think, like, what else do you need? People think that all you need is love. That's not the case. You also need a sense of achva. What's achva? Achva is brotherhood. Because your brother is always your brother, and there's nothing you can do about it, no matter how hard you try. Your brother, your sister, those are relationships that you're stuck with for life. And you know that, so you better make it work. Unfortunately, sometimes in families, people have a rift, and they don't... And every simcha becomes awkward. This is a relationship that's there whether you like it or not. It's there for life. I heard a beautiful word once from Rav Asher Weiss. So the Gemara says, "Hai almas kevei hilula damya," that the world is like a wedding. Now, in what way is the world like a wedding? So Rav Asher explained, if you go to a wedding exactly on time, so I had a wedding last night, started at 6 o'clock. If you get there at 6 o'clock, who's there? Only the family. Only the family. The family is there. nobody else. If you stay till the very, very end, the last of the Sheva Brachos, who's there? Only the family. Sometimes the chassan will ask me, who do we give the Sheva Brachos to at the end? I say, the uncles, because they're the only ones that are there. It's only the family that remains to the very end. In between, all sorts of amazing and fun people that you meet throughout your life that are exciting and enrich your life and are great and are wonderful. But at the beginning and at the end, it's only the family. Rav Asher Weiss said, "Hai alma kebe hilul adami." Person comes into the world, he's surrounded with family. And then throughout his life, all sorts of different relationships here and there. At the end of his life, around his deathbed in that hospital room, who's singing to him? Who's saying vidui with him? It's only the family. It's important for a person to remember the permanence of certain relationships. And ava v'achva means that the marriage relationship has that sense of permanence as well. And that attitude permeates everything we do in life. The attitude of a disposable society where everything could just be upgraded. It's not only about our relationships. You know, there was a study that I found online. The University of Kentucky revealed that, I thought they only played basketball, but the University of Kentucky had done a study, someone in the University of Kentucky, two professors from the University of Kentucky did a study where they found that there's a crossover appeal of this trend. They write, we found a correlation between the way you look at objects and the way you perceive your relationships. According to the author Omri Gilath, they're always Israelis. If you move around a lot, you develop attitudes of disposability toward objects, furniture, books, devices, basically whatever merchandise you have at your home, your car even. In four separate studies, Gilath and co-author Lucas Kiefer of the University of Dayton tied the view that objects are disposable to an attitude that social relationships also could be replaced. And sadly, that attitude has affected the way that a lot of people view religion and religious institutions also. Not that long ago, I was driving a fellow from Far Rockaway home, and I asked him the difference between the shul he davens in and another neighborhood shul. He said, "Really? You want the honest truth? The shul I daven in is for people in their 40s, and that shul is for people in their 30s. And there's no other difference." Every decade of life gets its own shul, with its own multi-million dollar building, at least where I come from. It happens all over the country. It's undoubtedly a function of something, somebody looking at their mezuzah or their shul or their yeshiva or Rahman al-Islam, their spouse, and saying, it's not as beautiful for me as I would like. I think I could find a nicer one. And the end result is not happiness. Happiness comes from being dedicated to something, from going through the ups and downs and the frustrations, and then looking back and shepping the nachas from what was accomplished. So one of the keys to success in life, in marriage, in ruchnius, is not to tear down a kosher mezuzah. When we have something that's good and believe there's room for improvement, so improve it, work on it, and find joy and fulfillment in that which we have. And through that, Be'ezus Hashem, we should all be zochet to great happiness.